This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Welcome back to Baseball Outside the Box. This is your host, Pete Caliendo. We're glad that you're joining us from all over the world. We are currently in Vancouver Island, Canada, where we just finished an outstanding coaches, players camp, where we had some great instructors there. This is, as you know, we just interviewed two of the instructors from the camp prior to this. So we're glad that you can join us again. And we are currently right now with Pete Wilkinson. And Pete is a great friend of mine. I've known him for a long time. I consider him one of the, you know, I know he's not going to like me saying this, but I consider him to be one of the greatest minds in the game of baseball when it comes to developing the athletes. And not just developing athletes, but also, you know, I call it the mental game. He's going to explain it a lot better than I do. But when it comes to also mentoring athletes, there's nobody better. And as far as, you know, teaching kids in general, I don't think there's anybody better. So I think it's going to be a great show. First thing we'll do is just like to welcome Pete to the show. And then our topic's going to be about developing, you know, baseball players to the highest level. Again, we're excited to have Pete on the show. And again, Pete, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Peter. I really appreciate being here. As you know, I've been excited about the topic of peak performance for a long, long time. And about the separation that we make in the mental game from the physical game, and then what it takes to play at the highest possible level, and not just the level of your neighborhood.
Yeah, you know what's great is obviously I've spent a lot of time here with you, and in the past years too, but also here, because currently we are snowed in Sydney, Vancouver. We were on our way to the airport, and unfortunately the big storm hit, and we're stuck here, but you know, there's a great benefit to that is that I get to talk to, you know, baseball the peak more. I already talked to him all weekend, whether it was at breakfast or anywhere else. I just, you know, kept talking baseball because you're always learning. So we'll do the best of it. And we got an opportunity to do the show from here. So I think we're excited about that, too. And if we're here tomorrow, maybe we'll even continue the show tomorrow. Let's do this. Yesterday, you and I talked for a while. And, my question to you, and it really went in depth. Was okay. You develop athletes, and obviously we talked about your background prior to the show. But you develop athletes, and you encourage athletes, from what I understood, to be the best they can be, but to shoot for being the best player they can be at the highest level. Explain that, because you're going to do a 10 times better job than I will. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, in simple terms, we want the kids that we work with. They have big goals. And we want the kids that we work with to be able to get to the big leagues at something. Now, that may be baseball, and that may be accounting, and that may be in corporate work. But whatever it is, there's a process of excellence. And that process applies to athletes in the same way as it applies to people in other walks of life. So what we do is work with kids to help them to not only prepare for the competition they have right in front of them, but the competition that they want to have later on. So we believe that preparation needs to match goal set. If your dreams are big and your preparation is small, the dreams that you have are pipe dreams. There's not much chance that they're going to come through. And while you need to develop the competencies that you need to a piece at a time, if you don't have the big picture in mind, you may not be preparing to play at the requirements that the game has for us.
And now take an athlete who, you know, is a high school player. How does he know? How do you know that if you're setting those goals for him that high, but yet his skill sets may not be at that level? How do you explain that?
The given is that skill sets aren't going to be at that level for almost everybody. There are a few who come along once in a while, and we usually know them by their first names and don't need a last name.
Or junior
last names. Junior would be one of those. Yeah. Edgar would be another one.
Right.
As you can tell, I come from Seattle.
Yeah.
so there are a lot of people who don't fall into that category, but they get to play too. I fell into that category at the University of Southern California a long time ago when I got to play there, and I was one of those who got to play too. I tried to prepare for the highest level that I could, and what we try to do is play is help kids understand what the preparation takes for the goals they have. If their goals are big, we'd like to work with them if they have a tool that might play there. But we want to prepare them not only for the competition across the position on their teams and for the competition across the ball from them, but also for the competition that they want to face, because they have to be prepared to contribute when they get there in most programs. And colleges are particularly aware of this. They need playability. They don't have someone for 10 years. So they need to get him or her to be able to play at least some the moment they get there. Now, that may not be all the time possible, but it's an expectation if people recruit you. They're typically not recruiting projects within their program at the level of the programs might be.
How early do you start a young kid in thinking this way, thinking that, you know, you got to shoot for the highest level? How early? I mean, we're talking about, you know, when kids are playing 12 years old, is that something that we want to encourage young kids to think already? Because, I mean, that's, you know, you want to dream the dream?
Some people have the maturity at 12 years old to know what it is they really want. I don't encourage anybody to set goals really high unless they really want to. If they don't want to, it doesn't matter what I do. It matters what they do, and they're going to play and practice at the level of their passion, and that's the highest level they're going to play. They're not going to be able to play, in my view, for very long beyond their passion. So they need to bring that, and then they need to bring the maturity to understand, one, that work can be fun, but it's not just fun and there's no work involved. And so they have to have some perspective of what it feels like to prepare and some love for that, or they need to have a lot of talent and the willingness to develop a love of the work. So we take their dreams, and some people are young enough at 13, 12 years old. I had an 11-year-old who did very, very well, and we had to make sure that we didn't burn him out because he would have done it every day. And we still believe that, as the science tells us, that balance works better than a single-minded preparation with nothing else in mind, that burnout is typically the occurrence of that. And then the only way to solve the problem is you got to walk away from it. And sometimes kids are too young at 15. So we encourage kids who are mature enough to have made determinations to get involved in the process with us that will help them mature as people while they're maturing as players. Because one thing we do believe, and that's that significant and lasting change is going to come from the inside and work its way out. It's not going to come from the outside and work its way in. But they have to bring a passion themselves. No one can substitute that for them.
Now, is that an easy evaluation of a player to determine when he can, you know, start thinking that way? Or are you making that choice? How do you... That can't be an easy decision.
Well, we don't take it lightly. Yeah. With some kids, it's relatively simple.
Yeah.
With other kids, it's really difficult because they don't know they don't know what they're talking about.
Right.
They may think they have a terrific work ethic, but really they don't. They may make excuses for themselves when really there aren't any. They may be so hard on themselves that may be the biggest hurdle they have to overcome, even more than the athletic side. So they all bring something different, and we have to evaluate what's real about the person as well as what's real about the player, and that's an imperfect science. The history of it all with us has been that our kids have succeeded at the level that they sought to a lot of the time, and when they failed, they've failed approaching it. There's some judgment involved in that on both ends. And are we the right people for them? Are they the right people for us? But more importantly, how determined are they? And then is there the capacity to grow and play and compete at the level that they want? And that capacity may be about competition, and it may also be about physical capacity.
Yeah.
And you have to have both at the big time.
And obviously you've been doing this for a long time, and there's a lot of players that come to you. Are there times where you don't take players for any particular reason? You know, you don't see something in them? Like you said, the work ethics or something else in, that you may decline a player into your program?
Most of the people, and by most I say about two-thirds of the people that we talk to, screen themselves out in a process preliminary to our ever looking at them in the conversation. You know, is this really serious, or is this just, if it happens, it would be really nice? And two, is there a skill that will allow them, and in our case, our judgment, is there a skill or a tool that will allow them, that individual, to play at the collegiate level, at one level or another in college?
Mm-hmm.
We're not looking to fill the ranks of professional sports. We're looking to be able to extend someone's playing career beyond college. Now, if he has a professional dream beyond that, that's great, and we'll evaluate the tool based on the highest level of his dream, but we'll also define it based on collegiate play, since most parents and most kids want to get, at some point, a college education. We typically don't take kids who have a disdain for education.
Yeah, that makes sense. And our talk yesterday, and I want to make sure I got this correctly, if a youngster, say a high school player's goal is at the highest level, which let's say that would be Major League Baseball, if you're shooting for that, okay, that's a good thing, because if you come up short, you're still doing pretty good.
Yeah, we hope that they fail at a higher level than other people that they would have had they shot for a little bit at a time. We're not trying to overload them with the work, because they still have, you still build skills on building blocks. You don't just dream it and it happens. But we do teach them techniques that will allow them to grow their skill, and in some cases and in some ways, if we get them young enough, grow their talent. And that's an important part of the process.
Yeah, and I want to hit this because you mentioned burnout. Tell me a little bit about, tell our audience, you know, how can a player get burnt out? Because you hear that a lot, you know, teams, a kid's playing, let's say a travel team, and he's got 100 games, and it's all he does is baseball, doesn't do anything else, he's not even, you know, hanging out with his buddies or anything. But how do you get burnout? How do you see it? And maybe this can help coaches identify it, could help parents identify it.
Burnout comes from the conflict with yourself that occurs when you spend so much time at one thing and so much energy at one thing that it consumes you. And once that happens, you get diminishing returns, and so you work harder, and then you get diminished capacity, which causes you to be your own worst enemy. And in those cases, the only way to cure the problem is to get away from it, and that's what burnout is. Burnout is our relentless drive, which eventually leads to our diminishing our own ability to play.
Now, parents can be a part of the issue, part of the process, but they can also be a detriment to the process. Explain how parents can really help their kids. You're helping them in one way, but I'm sure the parent has to be part of this also. How can they be helpful?
Parents can be a big part of the problem, but they are always, almost always, a big part of the solution. And with kids who grow up healthy, what we find parents are doing is, and by healthy I mean mentally healthy, emotionally healthy, is that parents are supporting what the child wants to do, what the young athlete wants to do, in balance with a lot of other things, and monitoring not only progress, but the process that he goes through and how happy he is doing what he's doing. Unhappiness doesn't breed anything. Kids tell researchers that the hardest part of playing sports is the ride home, and that's been the number one thing for a long, long time. But if that's for an individual kid not a problem, then he's free to chase a dream as opposed to he's made to chase a dream. Dreams diminish when have to substitutes for want to.
Now, you obviously, as we're talking here, are working with the athlete on his skill development. And, you know, I call it the mental part, but I know you have a different term for it. But as you have this process that you take the players through from the time you have them, you know, all the way up till a certain point. But not all players can come to you. So what advice would you have for coaches, whether, you know, we got coaches from all over the world, you got coaches in the U.S. obviously that listen to the show. How can they help develop the players in a way that you are? Now, obviously, nobody's going to be able to do it with all the experience you have, probably at this ability, but they've got to be able to help somehow because the coaches are going to be with them most of the time. How can that happen?
Coaches are better at this than they think they are often, and some of course, do it on purpose.
On purpose,
but... We tend at some point to be nurturing. Nurturing a player's self-awareness by telling him the truth is probably the first thing we coaches can do, and that applies to all of us. I get a lot of time with an individual, but a coach during season will get almost every day with him, let's say at the college level and certainly at the high school level. And we can be involved in the tearing down of the player, and we can be involved in the building him up. But building him up doesn't mean give him false confidence and tell him how wonderful he is. It's telling him the truth and helping him understand that there are ways to change the truth. And I was fortunate enough to play for a little league coach who did that, and play for two high school coaches who did that, and to play for a college coach who did that about as well as it's ever been done. In my opportunity to be associated with Rod Dedeaux. But it starts with tell the truth and help the student, the player, be self-aware. The more self-aware the player is, the better chance he has to fix the weakness he needs to fix and to grow the strength that becomes his tool. He has to do both. You can't sit there with 17-year-old skills and pretend they're going to play at 22. That just doesn't happen. And so it's a matter of empowering a kid to be his own best coach at some point, because they're with themselves more than they're with any of us, even those of us who may be with them in a program, whether that be a college program or a high school program, or in what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs to be able to deal with himself. And those are the first things that we deal with. Does he have an awareness of what's real about today, as opposed to what someone may have told him or what he believes to be, but has never really checked out thoroughly? A lot of kids have a favorite pitch to hit, for example, and what we coaches find out is you may love the pitch, but you can't hit it. And the one you're taking because you don't like it is the ball you can hit out of the ballpark. And so we help them understand that on a player, from a player standpoint. But from a personal standpoint, how do you think about those things? How do you deal with those things? How do you handle your emotions? And how do you do that are at least as important.
Now, you and I have talked, and you know, you said that, and I believe you, I'm remembering it correctly, coaches are leaders. It's all about being a leader, and you know, but how can a coach, because you know, coaches are so involved in working on the techniques a lot. How do you balance the two? What's more important, the leadership aspect that a coach has with all his players, the development part, equally both, or?
I've talked to a number of people who are both formal and informal advisors to me who played at the highest level and who competed at the highest level in business as well, but or in their business, which was non-athletic. And all of those people say that the highest level of development was in the major league organization that they're in, that the major league player learns the most in the big leagues because that's where people know more about what they're doing and about what the player faces at that level. Corporate executives generally have talked to me when I've asked the question that they had a mentor who actually competed at that level, that coaches have typically played at a high enough level that they were able to feel the same things that the player is going to need to feel at the level he'd like to get to. Bill Belichick never played at the level of a Tom Brady in terms of a level of excellence, but he'd been around the block enough to know what that looked like and to allow and empower a person like that who was willing to work that hard and do some things on his own to go do that and have some freedom to do that. And allow him to go do that. And there are thousands of other examples. Tom just happens to be pretty current in pretty exciting right now.
Yeah, especially after today or yesterday's game. Now, you also told me that you read a lot of books on leadership. You've done that for, you've coached over 40, 45 years that you've been in the game. And that's really helped you. So obviously, do you encourage coaches to read a lot of leadership books? Because, you know, we all can learn, but we're all, you know, you're not a born leader, are you?
Well, I think there may be some, but most of us, I don't think, are. I think leadership is a capacity that you develop. And my belief is that leadership is really simply defined as decisive acts of service, that leadership is service-based. It's not status-based. And leaders develop over time. They may have an inclination to lead, but ultimately motivation causes leadership to occur. And then when coupled with opportunity, it shows up and then it grows. So leadership is interesting to me. Should coaches read about it? I just think there's a lot of ways to figure stuff out in life. I don't think there's one way to do it. Most leaders have found some way to be well-rounded in the way they look at things,
mm-hmm.
And decisive in terms of their own philosophies and their own way of doing things. They may can be completely different than somebody else's way, but they're authentic. And authenticity, I think, is the single biggest virtue we can all develop.
And what about goal setting? You hear a lot of times, you know, everybody in general, but players especially, you should set a goal for the season. You know, it shouldn't be too high, but it shouldn't be too low. How do you encourage players or even coaches to talk to their players and help them set goals that are realistic? Or should they not be realistic? Should be, you know, way out there so that way you're shooting for the highest?
Yeah, if it's going to happen anyway, goal setting isn't going to change it. If it's not going to happen without some change, significant fundamental change occurring in the human, then it's probably a good place to start. But first and foremost, it has to be imaginable. If you can't imagine it, it's hard to chase it.
Mm.
You've got to be able to imagine it. It's why young players should watch Major League Baseball and actually go see it up close and personally if they can, if they're interested in playing in the major leagues. If they'd like to play in college, go see college games, see what college players do, and see how easy though the best of them make it look at the level they're at. But then to understand behind the scenes how much work there is to do in making it look easy. And to get real about where they might stand in the process right now, but to be able to imagine if they're climbing up the right building.
Yeah.
Is it worth it to be a great shortstop? Is it worth it to be to become a fabulous pitcher? Is it worth the time and energy that you're going to have to spend? Is it something that you think you'll like once you get there? It's a lot of us have climbed up the wrong building and gotten to the top and had to climb back down and start over somewhere. And I'm one of those. So that's a difficult process for anyone, but it's a process that I think we all need to be engaged in. And we adults have some responsibility to the younger generation to help develop that aspect.
You know, and I think it's a great idea that you mentioned, you know, go see colleges, you know, play, practice possibly, you know, pro guys, so you know the level that you're trying to reach. You have a lot of kids in college or high school kids, that even parents, that they may even go watch games, or they may even go watch practices, or they may even talk to some of the players and ask them, you know, what's the commitment that you've made at this college? You know, how hard do you have to work to be at this in this program? But yet, they're not realistic still. You know, their skills may not be to that level to go play at that college, but they think it is. How do you, I mean, that's tough for parents. You know, in other words, everybody wants, make it simpler, everybody wants to play at Arizona State, but everybody can't play at Arizona State. So how do you, is it the coach that has to finally say and be realistic and say, son, you're just not ready to play there?
Well, often that's true.
Yeah.
That has to happen. That's a tough one. I happen to believe that parents need to be a positive part of the process, so I'm reluctant to throw all of us parents under the bus. But having said that, there's a lot of truth to the fact that sometimes we get them to chase our dreams.
Yes.
And dads, obviously, more than moms. We're driven by success and those kinds of things. And that's part of our nature as fellas. But we need to step back and allow kids' behavior to dictate some things. Because while we may have a big dream, and he may say he does, and he may say it to please him, and he may say it to please us, or he may say it because he's supposed to. But what's really there is you're where your feet are. The NFL says you're what your record says you are, and there's a lot of truth to that. If you're not out there doing something when nobody's looking, and you have a dream to play in the major leagues, you have a problem.
Hmm.
At the very least, you have a problem.
Yeah. And but I do believe that. I think you brought up a great point. At least if parents and players go to the college and watch them play, watch them practice, and maybe it'll be a little bit more realistic. You know, they'll be able to say, well, maybe I'm not ready for this level, so I need to look at a different college to play at. So hopefully that can help. We are going to take a couple more questions with Pete, and then we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about another aspect of the game, because Pete's really good at the development also. I mean, really, really good. As you watch him work with young athletes, it's amazing, because we're going to discuss in the second half the how much do you practice the skills and the mechanics compared to letting kids just do it. That's going to be the second half of the show. But for right now, let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, I want to go back to the goal setting just for a second, because should kids set goals like batting averages? You know, this year I want to accomplish 300 or 295, whatever it is. Or I want to, you know, get on base this much. Or I want to strike out less. Should they set goals and then see if they've reached them at the end of the season? You know, let's say at the high school level?
They should set goals. There's no question about that. The worthiest goals are the ones that they have some control over. They have control over whether an at-bat's a quality at-bat or however they define it.
Right.
There are lots of definitions out there for it, some popular, some not so popular, but some tangible thing that they can control that says that they put best effort into an at-bat and got something out of it. The something out of it doesn't have to be a hit. If you set a goal for hits, that's great, but if you take that in a microcosm of a one-day deal, you can hit four line drives and be 0 for 4, and if it's all about how many hits you get, you feel like a failure, yet you don't have anything to fix if you hit four balls on the button in the directions you hope they would go. And you can break four bats and get two fly balls that got lost in the sun and a ground ball that didn't go far enough for somebody to throw you out, and you feel like you're on top of the world, and yet you didn't have an approach that worked very well for you that day. You just got away with it. So we encourage our kids to set goals that they have some control over and maybe make some predictions about that, what that will end up at in terms of result. But we want them to do things that they have power over, and then they can be accountable. You can't be accountable for the center fielder not getting there, or the center fielder getting there, or for a receiver making a great catch over the top of you when you had perfect position and you just couldn't get there.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that you can do really well and they turn out badly, and there are things that you can do really badly and they turn out well. Well, those are accidental results. What you're looking for is a result that you can command. We want to hit the ball hard with backspin. We want to move runners at the appropriate times. We want to set those kinds of goals because we have a competition going on about who will win the battle of did I get a job done. So the concept of productive outs in baseball and productive at-bats over time will lead to successful performance.
All right, super. You know, we, as I think a lot of coaches around the world understand, sometimes, you know, we tend to be a little bit too forceful when it comes to working mechanics. I know when I was a kid, that's all I worked on was mechanics. I looked great, you know, but unfortunately, you know, my batting average or even my my contact, you know, making contact with the ball wasn't great. So we're going to get into with Pete a little bit about, you know, what does he do when he first gets a player? And this is something that we'll address now. Pete, when you first get a player, and he comes to you and he want to work on his throwing or his hitting or any kind of skill development, what's the first thing you do with them?
Well, what I want to find out first is what's his capacity. Capacity matters if we're going to teach somebody anything. And kids who are in a strange environment will tend to dummy it down and strive to not make any mistakes. And so you find out very little about capacity. You find out more about their level of confidence. And I want to find out what's in there first and then find out about what's the level of confidence is. They'll show us that during a workout or during our first session. So first of all, I try to get them to be as big as they can be and find out where that breaks. And then be as fast as they can be and find out where that breaks. And what we do is use standards of the game at a level higher than they are. So if we get a high school kid, well, we're going to play to college numbers. And our best friend is a stopwatch at that point. The game's going to require an infielder to make a play in something under 4.0 seconds. And our standard is if you can make it at 3.6, you can probably play anywhere. If you can't do that, what is the level? And if it's 4.5, you're going to be an average to below average high school player. And so what is it that you need to be able to do will be determined by how fast the game requires you to do it. And so where is he now is the first thing we want to find out in terms of his ultimate capacity to do something that's skillful without breaking it down, without breaking down. And so what we're looking for is how fast is too fast? And is that a physical problem or is that a careful problem? And we make some judgments about that early and we'll test it. If we're looking at a position player, then we're obviously looking at him hitting. And you know, how fast can he make the bat go? How big can he make his move so that he can generate enough force to drive a baseball? How much ground force will he develop? Will he generate? Does the ball jump off his bat? We're not always with every player taking those measurements, but we're getting a pretty good idea for whether he's going to dummy it down and just make contact, or if he makes contact going as big as he can, that there's not enough in the tank strength-wise. And at least we'll know some of the requirements that he's going to have in terms of his training to be able to compete at the level that he'd like to on his way to where he'd like to go. You're not going to make a jump from a sophomore in high school to Major League Baseball in a minute and a half because we say be big. But what they can do is show us how big they can be in this moment, and that may project a little for us what their capacity might be later. Not by the specific number, but how much they leave behind in terms of their own willingness to generate energy and their own efficiencies, which generate energy, or take it away. And for a pitcher, we're not making it a velocity contest, but we do want to see how clean is his arm, how quick are his hand movements, how much does he get out of his lower half, how much does he get out of the upper half, where things break down. If nothing breaks down and his arm just doesn't go fast, that tells us something. If he has major disconnection is delivery, that tells us something too. If he's as good as you can be mechanically but doesn't generate any energy, then we have to figure out the whys and wherefores of that. If he generates a lot of energy but has 42 vectors going on in terms of where his energy's going, that tells us that there's another thing that has to be developed. And then we try to make some judgments about what kind of athlete we have, if it's a physical development problem, and then what kind of person do we have if it's more a permission-based problem where he won't give himself permission to be all he could be, and then figure out the reasoning for that.
Now, when you say big, you know, let's take a kid that comes in. Obviously, you're going to warm him up first, and then you're going to – does that mean if you're going to hit off a tee, do it as fast as you can? Let's see how fast you do it so it's more game-related, and now you know – how well he can do it?
Yeah, we'll get some sense of that, and we'll also know how well he'll handle this environment. if he's hitting off a tee, or if he's hitting off center or short toss, or if he's hitting off us at 30 feet away or 25 feet away, throwing the ball like a pitcher would throw it. Whatever we use for that particular moment, how far can he hit it toward a target? How much backspin can he create? What's the quality of his ability to load the bat, to launch angle and go with it? What's his current status in terms of creating and maintaining separation? What are the things he can do? What are the things he can't do if he stretches himself? And then where does that stretching cause him to break down? Now, in throwing a ball off a mound, we're real careful that we don't get somebody hurt. We're not going to go say, throw it as hard as you can before we know he's safe to do that and in shape to do that and all of that kind of thing. So that's not a first day deal.
But how do you tell if he's mechanically not good if he doesn't do it at a certain speed?
We do push the speed issue, but not the speed of the ball, the speed of his feet to the ground, how much momentum is he able to generate and still stay connected. What are those things, and where does that break down? We want to know where the breakages are.
And you can you check that without throwing a baseball?
We could, but we typically have a ball in his hand, and it's typically a baseball. But we'll have a ball in his hand and let him throw it. We may take the distance out of it so that he doesn't have to recruit a ton of strength out of sequence, and then see how it looks when he doesn't have to be strong just to get it there. So he doesn't have to muscle it up to feel that he's throwing the ball hard. We're going to let him flow, try to be an athlete, and see what comes out. In a first look, that's where we go. And then we figure out from there. Let's say we're already working with him. We'll figure out from there what needs to be done first.
Since we're on throw-in, and my audience is going to email me on this one, because I know I ask you all the time, you use the word vector 42. They're going to think it's some kind of spaceship, you know. So they're going to ask, where's the spaceship coming from? Explain on the throne a little bit because of what you said with the vector 42. I think is that all the energy going in one area, or
yeah, we like anyone in our business, our business being baseball, we'd like all the energy to be directed.
Yeah,
we'd like it to be directional, and we'd like it to grow into a crescendo when the ball comes out, if he's throwing, and when the bat comes out, ball comes off the bat, when he's hitting. So we're looking for the ways to create energy to be going in the same direction. The Patriots call it complementary football, like we're finding out this week. But what we're looking for is, do the parts complement each other and lead to efficient delivery and efficient gathering of energy and release of it? That's what we're looking for.
All right. Now, so you got the athlete. You've done a few things like that. We identified things. What's the next step now once you identify? And we could take a couple mechanics or a couple fundamentals. You know, if we're talking about throwing, if you identify something in his throwing, how's the correction process begin?
We, first of all, don't want to fix symptoms. We want to fix problems. And I've found over a long career that what a lot of the smart guys know immediately, and that's that most problems happen in setup or immediately afterward, that they happen at the beginning of the delivery, even if they don't show up until the bottom of the delivery. That typically the problem is always in front or in behind the result. The ball's high and inside, there are usually some reasons for that, and it's usually in the first or second move. 90% or more of what goes wrong really early. And so we'll typically fix problems that happen at the bottom of the delivery up at the top of the delivery.
And the same thing with hitting?
Yeah. If you set up badly, it's hard to swing well. And if you set up badly, it's hard to throw well. If your first move throws you off balance or gets you out of posture, it's really hard to recover. You're in recovery the entire time. And it's hard to be a major leaguer if you're in recovery all the time.
And, you know, I've listened to you talk this weekend. It also sounds that the hitting and the throwing movements and also some corrections are very similar.
Yeah, the signatures are very similar. And signature being that thing which one athlete does that's unique to him. The throwing signature and the hitting signature typically go hand in hand. And so for pitchers, for example, we will find what their hitting posture is and set that up as a pitching posture if they're not getting good results with the way they're pitching. For a hitter, it may be how do you throw the ball and where do you get? Because in throwing the ball, you're typically going to end up where your body feels strongest because it'll take you there. And so if you're going to be there at the end, why not start there at the beginning and keep the motion simpler? And so that's true for both hitters and pitchers. And also in fielding, as you transition from fielding the ball to throwing it, you need to get in a throwing position. But there's not just one throwing position there. Cal Ripken had a whole lot different throwing position than a Derek Jeter would have or a Sean Dunstan back in my generation. But they all were pretty darn good shortstops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I think that might be an important issue to talk about, throwing positions, because we typically tend to believe, you know, a lot of coaches believe that, you know, there's one throwing position, you know, the arm on a 90-degree angle, the release point by the ear, but that's not really reality.
No, we all have different ways of getting there. At release point, there are some fundamentals. At before release point, there are some fundamentals. But those fundamentals still have to operate within your own strength and your own flexibility and the individual's own way to get there. And if you mess up the wiring that's already in place very much, bad things can happen. And the most famous current golfer messed himself up pretty well when
sure.
he messed with the wiring.
Yep.
And that was too bad. But that's something that's very important to us. We don't want to substitute technique for athleticism. What we want them to do is complement each other.
Yeah, and when you mention wiring, you're talking about the brain?
Yeah, we're really talking about the way a youngster has developed his own athleticism. The way we humans are set up is that we're going to develop our wiring first. If you learn to go fast, we teach tempo first, because if you learn to go fast, there will be a tendency to go fast. If you learn to go slowly, then at an older age, it's really hard to speed it up very much because you're already geared to do it and everything in your body is saying slow down. So that's the first stage. And then the second stage is strength building. And then skill building comes after that. And a lot of what we do in our country is that we try to teach skills to people who aren't strong enough to have any. And we slow them down to do that, and we miss the wiring stage of their life where if they'll wire it, it'll stay. I mean, some people come back and are really rusty from non-competition. Other people come back and they're ready to go right away.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are usually the people who developed a lot of fast twitch quickly. And they're used to being at competition speed. And what we're trying to do with our athletes is get them first to competition speed and then build function and strength to be able to handle the speed they need to play at to be successful. And then beyond that, that's when skill shows up, when strength combines with wiring to create a way of doing it that's repeatable. And so what we're really looking for is, I think what every scout is looking for, repeatability.
Mm-hmm.
And what level does he repeat at? And if he repeats at a high enough level, then he projects to play. If he can't repeat at a high enough level, it's no way Jose is what we call it.
Yeah.
It's, we'll see you later, and it's been nice that you came.
Yeah, and, you know, I find this fascinating because we were talking about this at dinner the other night was, you know, a lot of coaches, including myself, you know, have believed for years that, you know, with youngsters, whether they're 8 years old or whatever age, when they first start throwing a baseball, that we need to really slow down, teach them the movements, and as they get better in the movements, speed up. But what we're really saying here is, no, you know, get them to start throwing the ball hard or fast. Do it fast because you want to train them to be fast right away. Plus, you can see what they do good or bad when you're doing that.
Yeah, there are several schools of thought, and one of them, which I reject.
Yeah.
One of them is learn to do it perfectly and then learn to do it fast.
Right.
And my feeling and my belief is that if you're going slowly, it's by definition not perfect. it's hard to be perfect if you go slowly. The slower you ride a bicycle, the more trouble you have staying on it.
Sure.
At some speed, the bicycle rides pretty easily. And so what we're trying to do is find a place where the bicycle can ride easily, but we want to find that place that's in the future that the bicycle will ride easily and grow into that, as opposed to, let's take it, if you race, for example, at Indianapolis and you learn to run at the bottom of the track perfectly, you have to learn to run all over again if you go halfway up the track. And if you're going to win, you have to race 3 inches from the wall. Well, that's a whole different skill. And so why learn it three times? And the third time you learn it, it'll be way faster than the first time you learned it. And then it's a separate teach. It's a completely separate act. If you can get used to being up there, even though you break a few cars, you usually do better. That's why rookies break cars there. They're trying to win. And trying to win is an important thing. If we're trying to win, we're shooting at targets, we're doing the thing that will help us win the ball game. This ball game may be like watching paint dry, but at some point we want to play where it's not like watching paint dry. And that means that we need to develop separately from the competition we're playing now. We need to use ourselves as the competition and see if we can grow ourselves through the process, as opposed to just beat Johnny. Because the competition for a kid in Texas might be in California or in Maryland or in Florida or in Ohio, and he's not going to meet him for some time. And ultimately, the competition is, if you're at the top of the game, the competition, because you have a target on your back, is you need to be better than yourself to maintain your position in the universe. And so what we're trying to do is help kids get comfortable being a stretcher of themselves uncomfortably. We want them to be comfortable growing through practice in discomfort and trying to stretch.
And the earlier they do that, the better.
The kids are resilient, so they get used to it real early and have fun with it if
sure.
That's the way of life for them. If a way of life for them is be careful, don't make a mistake, it's really tough to get them out of that mode and into the mode where competition occurs.
Yeah, and now I know you. You said, you strongly believe in this, obviously, but I know you that there's a little bit more than strongly believe. There has to be some kind of science research, some trial and error that really backs what you believe.
All of those things.
Yeah.
We read the science. We create a little bit of it, but we read the science. We look at what's real. Let's take Major League Baseball or let's take collegiate baseball at the top of the ladder. There are some requirements. There's a requirement for how fast a shortstop has to get to the ball and throw to first base to get the best runner in their lineup. There's a speed at which, if you're going to play in the major leagues, the ball needs to exit the bat to have a chance to find green grass or a wall or something else, and have you get to turn left instead of right. So there are things that the game requires, and so we start with those. What does the game require at the level that his dream is? And let's go practice to that. And if we fall short of the best at that and are in the middle of that, then we're an average major leaguer. If we can't do that, well, then maybe we're an average college player where we learn to play at a level where we were constantly uncomfortable. But because we always lived there, it wasn't a big deal to us. And so we weren't going to go choke over it. We just got used to being in that state. For the winner on the PGA golf tour, those people talk a lot about how nervous they are coming down the back nine of the last four holes with the lead or within a shot of the lead, and how eventually they live for that feeling, that discomfort, sweaty palms, if you want to call it that, and that's the difference in the people who win and don't. Those people who are the most comfortable with it will do the best because they won't get in their own way. And so we're trying to build an environment where kids will stretch themselves comfortably enough that they don't get in their own way and do what we all call choking to death.
Yeah, now to help our coaches around the world really understand this, because you know you've got coaches of all levels. If I've got let's take the young kids, because I think when you take the young kids, then as they get old, when you're working with older kids, it might be a little easier. But take a 10-year-old team. You've got your club. You're identifying, first you want to identify obviously for their fundamentals, I mean, you know, how they are. But yet you're practicing. if you're taking ground balls, you're still doing it at full speed, even if the their fundamental throwing or fundamental of the fielding's not very good or just below average?
It'll be way below average to start with, probably.
Yeah. So what do you do? Do you just continue? Do you do it full speed still?
Yeah, if you take time away from people, the unnecessary eventually goes away if they keep repeating it, especially if you put a watch on it. And there's a standard now of the time they have to meet today.
So you're saying it'll self-correct while they're doing it?
Yeah, and we know that's true.
That's awesome.
And frankly, this is not new to coaches who've done it for a long time, that if they hit enough balls, fielders take care of themselves. If you throw enough pitches to a hitter that resemble competition, they'll get better at competing.
But you still spend some time adjusting certain things to help them further that or do it faster?
We'll tweak. Sometimes we'll tweak when they get started.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can read a whole lot more just before contact than you think you can.
Sure.
And maybe your jump is a half a step quicker. And if you're a quarter of a step slower than your competition, you're still a quarter of a step faster if you leave a half a step early.
But there's going to be some coaches out there that are going to, they're thinking, well, wait a second, to make a correction and to make sure you do that correction, I've read somewhere that, you know, it takes over 1,000 times to do it. Do you still train fast while you're working on that correction?
Typically, yes. We may break the correction down and do, let's say it's transition from field to throw.
Mm-hmm.
We may put you in a fielding position. Let's say a shortstop's making a double play. We'll put him in a position to field the ball and set him up so that he gets the right hop in the right location to make a play. And typically he'll want to catch it on the two hopper that's right at him, somewhere to hit on his left within the frame of his core,
mm-hmm.
but somewhere on his left, because that naturally shortens up arm swing and allows him to be quick and transfer weight properly. And we'll have him do that as fast as he can reasonably do it. So that the ball comes out and he gets it in his hand and does it. We want to do that as close to game speed as we can do it, and we may isolate it, but we still want to go fast.
Oh, I see. So you're actually isolating what he needs to work on by making him doing that fast.
Yeah, and then we'll put pieces together and then work on the transition of putting the pieces together.
Yeah, and what's great about that is if you're a 10-year-old or if you're anybody, but at least when you're starting real young, like you said earlier, that's a lot more fun than sitting there and trying to do something slow motion.
Yeah, because slow motion isn't the way you get to play.
Right.
We think that as much as possible, you should be at where you need to play. And if you are, those are real reps. Reps that I don't call real are reps at speeds that will never happen. Do we want certain kinds of movements? Yes, but even those movements are going to be individualized. And there's a range of right. People who chase perfection in this game are going to be disappointed a lot of the time. But you need to be able to change a range of solid that you can live in and whatever you're doing. And targets help you with timing. This game has all of the ingredients of it. It's very difficult technically, but timing is the thing that breaks us down. And if we can time things well enough based on the goal setting that we do, the target to hit the ball to, creates a stride timing that helps us. And we do that subconsciously, so we don't have to train for it other than to set goals and commit to them in terms of where we'd like the ball to go. Those things are important in the process. That, the mental game, the brain is a physiological thing. First of all, everything is physical. And on the other hand, the body responds to the signals from the brain, so everything is mental. Breaking them down, it seems to me, even though we've done it that way for years and years and years, is a difficult proposition because they happen together. And so we create goals for everything we do, and we teach the power of commitment to those goals. If you're absolutely committed to the pitch outside, it's interesting how your hands will quit on the ball inside that you can't get to. But if you're just committed to make a good swing, it's amazing what you'll swing at.
Yeah.
And you may make a good swing at the wrong time for the wrong pitch, and then you have a mess.
Well, I love because I've seen it happen, obviously, this weekend especially. But I love when you talk about hitting a target and, in essence, trying to hit that target as a hitter. Say you're hitting, a ball to center field or right field and hit that target. is really helping change the mechanical movements of the body, or make them correct, make them better, but you're not doing it in a slow pace. You're actually doing it through the actual motion of hitting.
Yeah, we don't want you to develop four different swings.
Yeah.
We'd like you to be able to use a swing and create the timing that gets you to the target that you want. And the swing will adjust itself based on the pitch you get. Mike Epstein said one thing that has always resonated with me, and that is the perfect swing is the adjustment you make to the pitch you get. And if the adjustment is based in targets, you're not making an adjustment that's universal across the field. You're making a simpler adjustment to a particular result you're trying to get. And it'll happen subconsciously.
And the first thing came to my mind when you said, you know, about doing it and, you know, the body will make corrections, you know, it'll figure it out, is the Latin players, Dominican players, Cuban players, you know, they do it every day and they just keep doing it. You know, a lot of times they don't really have somebody there all the time, you know, making adjustments for them. Their body figures it out, and it seems like we're developing athletes that way, or athleticism.
Yeah, my little league coach said to me that a lot of the process is digging it out of the dirt, not just getting information from other people, that you needed to dig your own game out of the dirt. And I've heard this from baseball professionals now for decades, that they want players who've dug it out of the dirt, who know who they are, who know what they're trying to get to, who know what they're trying to be. And the more that develops, the better the athlete becomes within his own ability to create a skill set.
Yeah.
And so for the... It seems that there are great many shortstops in pro ball who come from places where walking is not a good thing, that they're going to swing at bad balls, and people will criticize that and say, you know, he just swings at too many bad pitches. And I said, yeah, but he's learning how to do it correctly in the big leagues,
yeah,
which means that he's playing at a tempo that's fast enough to play at the level that he's at, and the big leagues is where he is. And he's going to learn while he's in the big leagues. And that's what all of the big leaguers that I've talked to have said that they've done. They were able to get to the big leagues, and then they learned a lot.
Wow. And this is something you and I had talked about also, and that's why I love sitting down talking baseball. And we both are strong believers in this, but you explain it really well, you know, and coaches are afraid of it a little bit. And I understand why, because, you know, it's the game a lot of times for all levels, it's about winning. So coaches want to control the game all the time, and they don't allow players to do things on their own, whether it be calling signs, whether it be stealing, whatever it may be. Give us your information or what your belief. How young should kids start, how young should kids be taught to play the game on their own and to make mistakes? Or should we wait till later because, you know, early on you don't want to disappoint them?
Yeah, if we don't teach kids to keep score, they teach themselves. They get to wanting to keep score faster because competition is something that's inside all of us humans.
Yeah.
And so they're going to keep score. They should be allowed to go figure it out. You can win before you're good. Most teams win before they're supposedly ready to. And the dynasties all do that. They win before they're good. And they get better after that. And there are plenty of examples of nobody needs me to name them.
Mm-hmm.
But winning is its own skill, and winning dictates how fast and how well you're developed. Your skills will develop. If there's no goal bigger than you, then progress will be slower. Very few people develop, very few competitors, maybe no competitors, develop the art just for its own sake. They may want to be artists, but at some point they want to sell a painting.
Mm-hmm.
They want to play at a level, and you can play at a level before you're totally competent to play at the level, and virtually every big leaguer does. That we take an A-ball player, and he goes to double A, and we recognize he's going to struggle there for a while. And the more he's prepared for it, the shorter the struggle. Not the less the struggle, but the shorter the time for it, because he's already in the mode of growing into things.
But if
buy a house that's too big for you to start your family.
But
those
things. But if you've got a 11-year-old team, 12-year-old club, you know, you let them start, you know, calling their own pitches, even though it might only be fastball, changeup. Do you let them run the bases on their own in certain ways? You allow them to make pickoff moves on their own. You know, do they play the game on their own, or is it still structured and dictated by the coaches?
I want to structure the heck out of practice. I think practice belongs to the coaches. But at every level that I got to play, I played for coaches who let us be in charge of the game. And that was true of my Little League coach, and it was true of Rodato. He wanted us to play the game ourselves. It was our game. It was not his game. He might help us with the management of pitchers and substitutions and that kind of thing. But when we played the game, we're supposed to know what to do. And I've heard, again, major leaguers say, if the players don't know how to play, that's on the players. And we want to help develop players who know how to play. And the only way they're going to know how to play is to need to trust themselves and each other. That the best way to develop communication is make them accountable for what happens instead of blaming them for all the bad things that we caused by making all of the decisions. If a player is looking in the dugout to find out what to do, it's way too late in this game. This game is played in 4-second bursts.
So it's important that coaches out there, how they set up their practices and training is extremely important, because then kids can take that right into the game and play the game on their own.
Yeah. Exactly. They need to be able to play the game on their own. And then we can help them. We can slow the game down so they can breathe a little bit. We can speed the game up so that they can create some momentum. We can teach them to win the lulls, which is very important in baseball. We can help them maximize big innings. We can help them do those kinds of things by putting the game in motion, or by slowing it down a little bit and maybe taking it out of motion if we're overmatched in one area, and try to win it another way. And we can help in that strategizing. But within the strategy, in playing the game, the players need to make their own decisions, because they're going to have to.
Yeah.
And as long as they're going to have to, we should be encouraging it.
Well, help our coaches around there. Again, because we're dealing with different levels, help them a little bit with the younger the players are, once we start encouraging and doing things on their own. Now, we realize that the coaches may not have enough practices to, you know, to cover everything, so kids are going to make mistakes, naturally. I mean, everybody's going to make mistakes. How does a coach deal with all those mistakes? Because that's the hardest part probably for coaches. You know, first of all, it's tough for coaches, I think, more than players when they lose, even at 12 years old. Parents take it tough. Kids take it tough. Coaches take it tough. So, you know, all these mistakes that go on during a game, how does the coach deal with that, and how does he take it as a positive into the future?
Well, mistakes are opportunities to learn something. The mistakes that coaches should be upset about are lack of effort mistakes, not being present mistakes, but the mistake of throwing to the wrong base, the mistake of booting a ball, the mistake of not being in the right place at the right time, but having gone somewhere with great passion. Those are mistakes that we should go, that's okay. That's okay. What do we learn from that?
Mm-hmm.
The mistake of not bringing effort, that's a different problem. That's a character problem. That's not a, or an attention problem. It's not a physical problem. It's not something that happens because the game got too fast for us.
Right.
If the game gets too fast for us, that's another argument to teach it a little faster tempo. But there are going to be mistakes. This game is a game that demands a sense of humor. And we have to be able to laugh at it. And the older that I got as a player, the more we were all involved in what we call graveyard humor. Mm. In that things got to be pretty funny, or and if they didn't, you couldn't stay relaxed enough to play.
Yeah.
It's hard to play this game tight. And so one of our ways of keeping us all loose, and this is still going on in the game, and particularly at the higher levels, is to make as much fun of it as you can.
Yeah.
And some of it's actually pretty darn funny.
Yeah.
So it leads to some real interesting things out there. But if you play free enough, and you play competitively enough, and you're willing to be loose about it and energetic about it, you get through the mistakes. The winners make. John Wooden said that the winners, if you're going to win a lot of basketball games, the team that made the most mistakes would win, as long as those mistakes were productive. Going a little too fast was a productive mistake. Getting totally out of control may not have been, but going a little too fast and getting excited, that was okay with him. The team that didn't make any mistakes wasn't doing enough. And in baseball, this is absolutely true. So mistakes of commission, I was taught, were way better than mistakes of omission.
Now, we didn't talk about the hitting part that much, but I do want to address it as our, as we end the show here a little bit, because you and I have talked about this, and I want to make sure our audience understands it. You know, when we get a kid that's hitting, you know, he's working off the tee and all that, again, a lot of coaches, including myself, we tend to work on mechanics a lot, but you don't. You tend to work on the tempo, the rhythm, and, you know, the doing it fast, and then the adjustments come. Kind of explain that a little bit so it can help our coaches.
It starts with two things. One is, if you don't have rhythm, there's no way you can have timing. And timing is what breaks down for most hitters. So we start there. We're trying to develop some rhythm. And secondly, you have to be on time. But it seems to me that major leaguers fight from late to on time. And amateurs fight from let's stride on Tuesday to swing on Wednesday. And that's the enemy of rhythm.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to be explosive through the strike zone. And that means we need to be on the ground, but 20% of our power is in momentum. So we want to move and be a little sideways and make rotation happen when it can do some damage. And the early striders are also early rotators. And if they're not, they're not going to be very quick, and they're certainly not going to be explosive. So what we're trying to do is time the target with this pitcher based on his fastball and learn to swing the bat in a way that will create backspin consistently in some range of launch angles that make some sense. That ultimately will create exit speed. Be on time, but don't come to the party a half an hour early.
Yeah.
No hostess likes it, and frankly, pitchers love it.
Yep.
So if a pitcher loves it, then the hitter can't afford to.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is that we're trying to be on time and in rhythm. That's the first thing. And then don't fix something that doesn't break the swing. There are ways to be stronger. There are ways to tweak a signature swing that don't mess up the person hitting. And then there are ways to get to perfect mechanics that blow up the subconscious of the hitter and make him an unfeeling, unable to adjust kind of person. And that guy won't hit.
I'm assuming that's the old saying, paralysis through analysis.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, and most of it's happening at the younger levels.
Yeah, and when you say signature, you mean all of us have a swing, and that's our signature. However we swing, we swing.
Yeah, Hunter Pence has a signature. David Ortiz has a signature. They don't look much alike.
Right.
Albert Pujols has a signature that doesn't look much like Ortiz's, and he has different things he struggles with.
Yeah.
David will struggle with one set of stuff, and Albert will struggle with others. They're going to have their own ways to get through those struggles. And you know, obviously two Hall of Famers there.
Yeah.
But we're looking at swinging the bat as one of the most athletic things you have to do. It's not a technical skill. There's some technical aspects to it that have to be consistently done. But there are fewer of those than everybody thinks. And what we want is to be able to get to the places where the technique has to happen in ways that force the technique, that make the technique inevitable. We want the imperative to be inevitable, because if you have to fight your way there, you can't repeat enough to make it happen.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I love it. And I think back, and we are coming to the end of the show. I think back, you know, I've heard other speakers, you know, there's 42 things that happen in the swing, you know, and now that, and I can see where we just become mechanical and destroy the swing by thinking that way. We usually end the show, and this is the way we like to end it. We like to give our guests the open mic to kind of tell our coaches and parents around the world anything, you know, that you'd like to give them, especially coaches, advice on working with players. So anything you want to talk to the audience about, just let it roll, and then we will end the show on that.
Well, I think the most important thing for all of us coaches, and I know that players talk about it with regard to their big league managers, and I know that managers, the ones that I know have talked to me about trust. You need to be able to trust the player, and you need to develop a player that you can trust. And so for coaches, we need to trust in our players' ability to learn what we want to teach them, and then we need to teach them the amount of things and the depth of things that they can handle. Not that we think they need, but that they can handle, and allow them to play freely within that particular system, if you want to call it that, and to develop some philosophy about how we want to play the game and instill that in them, perhaps, but to allow them within that philosophy to be who they are. Part of being successful, if we want to call it winning, call it winning. If you want to call it personally successful, call it that. Part of that is getting the opportunity to be good, to do the things that we're good at. And for coaches, that means to give kids opportunities that help them to get into situations where they can do things that they can do. And so if you play to strengths all the time, you're a hard person to beat and you're a hard team to beat. So a lot of our responsibility is trusting the kids and then identifying how they can help and then allowing them to do that. And I don't think that's rocket science, and certainly not new. We're watching that in the NFL with some coaches. We're watching that at Major League Baseball levels. Mm-hmm. We're watching that in college. We're watching the difference in confidence levels when things are bad among teams that are playing to their strengths and know it's a matter of time versus people who are constantly trying to shore up weakness for whom every day is a bear fight. And so if we can make it enough fun in the way we go about it and in helping kids discover the things they're good at, they'll grow. And as long as they're growing, we're going to have good teams.
That's great.
So that's the thing that really matters to me.
That's great. That's a great ending to the show. Pete, thanks a lot for being on the show. I know I want to get home. You want to get home. In some ways, I hope everything works out for us tomorrow. But in some ways, I hope it doesn't, so we get a chance to talk more baseball. But again, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Peter. I appreciate it.
All right. You are just listening to Baseball Outside the Box. We have been in Vancouver Island, Canada. What a beautiful place. We just had the opportunity to work with great coaches who asked great questions. Pete and I did a coaching clinic along with some other instructors from all over the U.S. and also the Czech Republic. It was an outstanding clinic. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget that the listeners are, you're the ones that make the show happen. So don't forget to go on social media and talk about Baseball Outside the Box. You know, we've got a Twitter at Baseball Out. Facebook is facebook.com/baseballoutsidethebox. And our email, which we love getting from you, info@baseballoutsidethebox.com. We love your questions. We love your comments. Stay in touch. Make sure that you also join us on Twitter. But join us also on Google, along with the different podcasts that we have on a lineup media group. And remember, coaches, education is the foundation of our sport. So keep getting educated by listening to our show. And also, there's a lot of other shows out there that you can learn from. So remember, I'm your host, Pete Caliendo from Vancouver Island, Canada. Have a great coaching day. We'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.